requests. Some of the Talmidim asked me to explain a certain Maimer Chazal. So we said that on Sunday that we will switch over to in Yaakov. So this was this is something from a Chazal in Tainus, and it's a very short Chazal. And I thought maybe I would, try to explain what the Chazal means, okay? It's a very interesting Chazal. Chazal say, it sounds like it is a interesting story here, that the source is Tainus of Ches Me'alef, okay? So the Gemara says like this. The Gemara talks about Bale Amona. Bale Amona means people that live with truth. Especially, Rashi says, especially means that Bali Amona means that a person that's honest in business. So Chazal say that Engishamem Yordim Elabashil Bali Amona. That Bali Amona means people that are honest and live by the truth, regardless of the fact that they have the ability to lie and be deceitful. So the Gemara says that the Chazal say tell an interesting story. Gemara says like this. Gemara says, "Vamar Abami Bo Rei Kama Gedolim Bale Amona." Take a look at how great Bale Amona, how important, how significant Bale Amona are. Minayin, where do you know this from? Mechuldo Bor. Gemara has two words. Chuldo Bor. Now, what is Chuldo Bor? And we'll get to what Chuldo Bor is. But the Gemara learns that a kal v'chomer. Amahamamin b'chuldo bor kach. A person that believes in a chuldo bor has such a reward or such an outcome. Hamamin b'kadosh baruch halach kam v'chomer. A person that believes in God is certainly the results will be even greater than the case of the chuldo bor. What's the case of chuldo bor? It's a chuldo bor. Chuldo bor is We'll take Tesis actually. Rashi gives the story. Tesis is a little more elaborate. We'll take Tesis the way Tesis recounts the story. So yes, Pirish Hamaimin b'chuldo bor. Person who believes in the chuldo is a weasel and bor is a pit. Okay, I forgot to translate. Okay. Says Ma'isa Hoya ben Irachas. It was a story with one young lady. She was traveling to her father's home. She wanted to go visit her father. Of course, it meant, traveling in those days meant you had to leave civilization. You went into the woods. Okay, so there was a boar on one of the roads. The roads weren't in those days, like today's roads. And there was a pit, an open pit as she was walking. The nafla, and she fell. So one young man came. V'amar, and he said, "Imani aleich, if I'll pull you out, take you out of this bar, tinasi li, will you marry me?" Romantic story. Good deal. Okay. Okay. Apparently, he had other qualities over something. Amralo, so she said to him, "Hey, okay, I agree." The nishbu beinehen, and they made a shvua. They swore between them, shehu lo yisa isha cheres, he won't marry another woman. He lo tinose le isha cheres, she will not marry another man. Okay, I mean, like I say, now whenever you have a mice and chazal, of course the mice is bekitzer, but apparently. They started a talk and they appreciated each other's personalities and they fell in love with each other, and it reached the point where I don't know whether it was before I took her out or after, but whatever happened was that they fell in love with each other and they made a bond between them, and they swore that he won't marry anybody else and neither will she. Okay, so V'omru, and they said, "Mi meid beinenu, who will be the witnesses between us. In other words, who's going to testify, attest to this commitment? There was one weasel that happened to be walking by the pit at that time. And they said, Elu Shnayim. Here you have two. We have two witnesses. Bor v'cholda, yiyu edim beinenu. Says the pit and the weasel should be witnesses between us for our commitment. V'holchu l'dakam, and they went on their way. All right, and it says v'hi amda b'shvuasa. She was loyal and faithful to her shvua, to her swearing and her commitment. Who now see Shacharis? He went and married another woman. Forgot the whole story. He was the one that made the bargain to begin with. Sure, he can't rely on anything. So then what happened? It says Violda Bain, and she gave birth to a son. And she gave his wife, in other words, the other wife that he married, right? She gave birth to a son, Bos Chuldov and Oshchoso Mace. So a weasel came by and bit the child, and the child died. Violda Lo Bain Cheney, then she gave birth to him, to a second son, the Nofal Labor Mace. This second son fell into a pit and died. Amra Lo Ishto, so his wife said to him, Maze Hamasa She Gialanu, Shalokish Orbene Odom. What is this strange occurrence that happened to us? That is an unusual type of occurrence that happened to us. Something strange. Not out of the realm of the normal. So it says, Niskar Shvua. So he remembered the swear that he made, the Shvua. The Siper Le Ishto Kolamaisa. And he told his wife the whole story. Amrlo, so she said to him, and Cain, if that's the case, Chazor v'kochano, go back and marry her. The Kosav Loget, that's quite a woman. The Kosav Loget, and he wrote her a get, v'holach v'nosa sabasula. And he went and he married the first one that he made the commitment to. V'hainu d'amri, and that's what it says, hamamin b'bor v'chula. He who believes in the pit and the weasel, shemidu a dusan, because their testimony was established. Okay, that's the story. So the Gemara says that madach a person, kavachama, madach, I don't know how to translate madach. Madach a person that believes in a pit and a weasel. This is what happens to them. Apparently the Gemara is praising them that they lived up to his commitment. And so Marach, a person that believes in a pit and a weasel, this is so Alachas Kama Vachama HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, I mean, it's a strange story. It doesn't. Questions, you don't have to raise any questions. It's like Rashi sometimes says. Rashi asks a kasha. Sometimes Rashi says, Eina mikra omar ela darshani. I mean, there's too many questions here. You know? I mean, you have to interpret what it means. It demands interpretation. That's the story in the Gemara. Of course, one question I would ask is just not on the story itself, but the Gemara says, I mean, what are Chazal saying? First of all, ma'amamin be baruch hulda, alachas kama kama kadosh baruch. It sounds like these people were not really on a very high level, because he really changed his mind because of certain events. He got scared. I mean, he got frightened. He saw the baruch hulda coming back at him. So he backed off. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like a high level. And the Gemara is saying l'shvach. Apparently, if a person believes in Baruch Hulda, Allah's kam v'chamakar. Baruch. Yeah. So Rashi shemisim. What does mean Allah's kam v'chamakar? Baruch Hu shemisimo ei beino levein chaver Allah's kam v'chamo. Okay, certainly if places HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the, makes HaKadosh Baruch Hu the aid. So it's certainly that's the way it should be. What exactly, I mean, the Gemara is saying, I mean, it doesn't finish it off. I mean, that's what, so therefore what? I mean, what does it mean? He'll definitely get an onesh. I mean, what's the continuity here? And what's the Kal Vachomer? But also interesting is, apparently the Gemara looks down on the person in some sense, because it says, because he's Mamin B'Bor Chulda. Of course, it doesn't mean he believes in a Bor Chulda. That would simply be nonsense. That would be kishuf. I mean, nonsensical thing, ideas which Yehadis abhors. But it's talking about, it means to say, some other kind of mila, some mila about the Bor Chulda. I mean, what is this mila? But besides that, the Gemara seems to be saying that the highest level is Maimon B'Kadosh Baruch Hu. You shouldn't use a Bor Nechulda. Seems to be Bor Nechulda, you know, is a level. But a Kadosh Baruch Hu, certainly, that's the ultimate. But you have really in the Torah, you have, you can ask a kasha from the Torah itself. Why? Because what did Moshe Rabbeinu say to Klal Yisrael? Azino Shemayim V'Adabera V'Sishma Oretz Emrefi. So Moshe Rabbeinu used Shemayim V'Oretz as Eidim. Okay, it's better than Baruch Hulda. But really, if you're saying that the idea is that Hamamin and Baruch Hulda, but really a person should really use HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Allah's Kamechan, so Moshe Rabbeinu shouldn't have used Shemayim V'Oretz even. Even though it's bigger than the Baruch Hulda, he should have said HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the aid. Okay, Tazin Hakadosh Baruch Hu. Hakadosh Baruch Hu should listen in, and he should be the aid. Why do you say Azino Hashemayim V'Aretz? I mean, okay. So obviously a number of things that have to be understood in this Maimon Chazal. Actually, I think what the Maimon Chazal is saying is really, you know, I mean, there's one true philosophy, but there are many false philosophies, and many false philosophies. And what Yehadis does, and through Maimori Chazal especially, is they rule out many false philosophies, and a lot of these false philosophies actually became philosophies over the ages. You know, because man thinks, and man thinks many times incorrectly, and all the philosophies besides the philosophy of Yehadis is of necessity false. So many times, Chazal, even though they never heard of a particular philosophy, but they are outruling certain philosophies that later became philosophies. Okay, because they're outruling that which is false. I think what this Chazal is ruling out is the philosophy known as pragmatism. Okay, philosophy known as pragmatism. So what is pragmatism? Okay, anybody want to volunteer? The philosophy of pragmatism. Pragmatism maintains that there is such a thing as truth. There's such a thing as truth. You can't deny there's such a thing as truth. But the question is, what value does truth have? All right? So pragmatism maintains that truth has a practical value. In other words, if you're in line with truth, there are many practical benefits that you gain from it. First of all, I mean, the simplest one is like Mark Twain says, you don't have to keep remembering what your lie was. So you don't have to keep distorting and keep lying in order to be consistent, because the truth is naturally consistent. Okay, but aside from that, there are practical, in other words, the truth is nothing more than a certain practicality which we find ourselves in. Okay? That's the value of truth. It has a certain practicality. There is a reality out there, and if you're in line with that reality, so then you're going to benefit from it. If you're not in line with it, you won't benefit from it. But that is the sole value of truth. That's really what pragmatism is. People, that's what people use the word pragmatic, they instead of practical. They want to sound more intelligent, but most of the time it's misused. But anyways, the word pragmatism means that the value of truth is in its practical results. Okay. For instance, but sometimes William James argues, but sometimes it's not good to be truthful. If I'll show you an instance where it's more practical not to be truthful, so then that is the correct way to go. All right? For instance, says if a person is on a cliff, hanging on a cliff, and they have to jump from the cliff to a nearby rock. Okay, and it's a big leap, dangerous leap, thousands of feet of abyss. And if you miss your leap, you're going to fall to your death. Okay, so a person that finds themselves in that situation, James says it would not be a good idea for a person at that moment to really be truthful. Why? Because the truth of the matter is, he may make it, he may not. Chance. The leap may be successful, the leap may not be successful. He says at that moment, the person must only accept the truth that he's definitely going to make it. Because if he accepts that idea, I say truth, I mean that idea, okay, that idea that he's definitely going to make it, then he can make it. In order for him to make it, he must have in his mind that he will 100% make it. Because if in his mind he doubts that the leap is going to be successful, this would prevent him from making the leap. Because the mere doubt would prevent him from executing a successful leap, because emotionally, if he thinks he might make it, might not, he's not going to be able to do it. So the only way he could do it is by lying to himself and by telling himself he definitely is going to make it. If he lies to himself and tells himself he's definitely going to make it, then he can make it. So therefore, you see that truth is merely a pragmatic, practical tool, and therefore sometimes you should be in line with the truth, sometimes better if you're not. I mean, in this case, if a person is going to be honest, they'll say, look, the leap is, 50%, he's stuck there, he's going to die, a 50% chance. But if he thinks at the time that he's leaping, he only has a 50% chance, okay, so then, ipso facto, by that very fact, he's going to miss his leap. Okay, he's going to miss his mark. So therefore, he says that it is important sometimes for a person, okay, not to be truthful. Okay. That's his point, okay? It's a good catch. There's no inherent value to it. Truth is really something which we should embrace because of its practical value. But sometimes it's more practical not to be truthful. So then we should be not truthful. That's basically his argument. Alright? In other words, he's saying truth, you see, has no absolute value. There's no absolute of truth. Okay? So therefore, truth becomes merely a vehicle of survival, basically. Okay? Right. In other words, the leap demands a certain assurance at the time of the leap, and if you don't have that assurance, you're just not going to get to that rock. You're going to fall in between. Okay? I mean, that's the way. That's his argument. And now I want to make it clear. I'm not an authority in pragmatism. I haven't read too much pragmatism. You know, I have a bad habit. I read philosophy, read one thing, it turns me off. I just stop making things. But once you do this, okay, then you, I'm merely presenting his argument. Once you do this, of course, you open up a whole world. Because then you could say religion. What about religion? Depends. If practically it's good, so what do you care if the ideas are nonsensical? I mean, they may be nonsensical, but they get you through. I mean, let's say, for instance, a person has to, in order for a person to live, he has to have some emotional security and belief in some kind of an angel or something, right? So it's necessary. It's necessary for his disease. He's not going to make it unless he has this. So what should he do? So James would say, believe in the angel. That's it. You see what I mean? Once you open up this whole floodgate, once you open up this an area like this, I mean, now you have a whole new world opens up. That's basically the argument. Yahadis, of course, maintains just the opposite, because Yahadis maintains that if a person, in order to survive, has to believe in some form of Avodah Zorah, Kishuf, or whatever it might be, he's better off dead. Okay? So Yahadis does not go along with that. So getting back to the Maamar Chazal, I believe that's really what the Maamar Chazal is saying. See, what is the Bor and the Chulda? What is it? They're not crazy. They know that a Bor can't talk and a Chulda can't bear testimony. But what it means, what they said was that these two elements there, one was an inanimate element and one was an animate, and they said that these two things are real and they're part of nature and they have a certain objective reality, and we commit ourselves based upon this reality. Which means to say, that was the shura. Which means to say, what they said was they rejected pragmatism. They said that there is such a thing as real truth, something that's real. This chulda is real, this animate object is real, and this inanimate object is real. And they said that we swear by that reality, which means to say that the commitment between us is not just a practical kind of a vehicle, it's not practical, but it's an absolute. It partakes of absolute reality, just like the reality of this existence, the pit and the inanimate, and also the animate, the chulda. In other words, what they said was that this chulda and this bor exist in reality, and that's a metaphysical phenomenon. It's a metaphysical phenomenon. In other words, these things have an objective, absolute reality. And our commitment is not a practical, political kind of act, which is just concerned with pragmatic results, but it is an actual, realistic commitment, as real as this chulda is and as real as this bor is. That's basically what they said. That's what they said. They said the commitment is not a pragmatic one, not a practical one. It's real. We believe in a certain reality. And therefore, truth is real, and we commit ourselves to that reality. In other words, there is a metaphysical reality of truth, just the opposite of pragmatism. And we're committing ourselves to that metaphysical reality. That was the commitment.
What?
So, excuse me. They use an example from two parts of nature, the animate and the inanimate, basically. And the inanimate that they had with them was the boar, and the animal was the chulda. That's what they had. Just like these things are real, and just like their existence is real, so too our commitment is real. And truth is an absolute reality. Just like these two things exist absolutely, so too our commitment is absolute. That's basically what they said. It doesn't mean that they were stupid and they thought that the boar is going to come back and testify, or the chulda is going to start talking. It doesn't mean that. It means that they were intelligent people, and they convinced each other that by expressing the fact that everybody has doubts when a person makes a commitment, because you feel the person is making a commitment for an ulterior motive. Okay, but then when the situation changes, then they could change their commitment. They could lie, they could distort, deny. So that's what they said to each other. They said, we recognize, they were intelligent people, we recognize that man basically is a political animal, which means he does things strictly because of his own personal gain and not because he's in consonance with any kind of truth. But we at this time commit ourselves to the reality. This commitment is a reality just like the chulda and the bor, just like the animate and the inanimate parts of nature are real. That's what they said. But they used the two things that were in front of them. Okay, to make it something you could be toe face on. Okay, and no one just say you be toe face on these two things. All right. What? Yeah. Eida galazev eida matzeva. That's good. Rabbi Meir mentions eida galazev eida matzeva. That's what it means. It means to say this, just like this thing is real, so too is our commitment. It's not simply a practical kind of a practical arrangement, which can be broken.
You see, also by Eric?
So there were people on a very high level. So that's why Chazal commend them. That's why Chazal say that madach a person uses as reality. He uses the bor and the chuldo, which is a piece of reality. Amaymin v'akadosh baruch hu alachas kama v'chama. If a person has before his mind's eye the source of all reality, and he has a tfisa in the idea and the reality of the mamtzi kol nimtza, and that's what is really in front of his mind's eye when he goes through life and makes commitments. Allah has kama v'chama. That's certainly a higher level. That's certainly a higher level. Not everybody could be on that level. So they needed the bor and the chulda in order to be toe-face on something. But a person that has before his eyes the mamtzi kol nimtza, the borei olam, Allah has kama v'chama, how much more powerful is such a commitment, how much more real is such a commitment, and Allah has kama v'chama, how much more a person like that has schar if through his life he doesn't need the bor necholdo, but he understands the Rambam of the Yisodos, Vamana Chachmos, Leida Sheyeshom Mamtzi Rishon, Mamtzi Kol Nimtza. So then that individual, such an individual, is certainly on the highest level. That's exactly what the Gvat Chazal is saying, basically. Okay? So really, Chazal is a rejection of pragmatism. That's basically what this Chazal is. There's another interesting part to the Chazal. The other side of the Chazal is something else. Come back to that in a moment. But now let's approach the question that we raised of Hazino Hashemayim Vadabero V'Sishma Aretzim Refi. So if that's the case, Moshe Rabbeinu Adon Kol HaNeviim. I mean, why didn't he say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be? HaKadosh Baruch Hu should be made. Why was he using Shemayim Va'aretz? Okay, that's the question that comes to mind, right? Yeah, yeah. Rashi's Hazina Shemayim Shani Masra Bam Yisro V'Tiu Atem Eidim B'Davar. You should be witnesses. Shekach Amarti Lahem. She'atem tiyu edim v'chein v'sish ma'aretz v'lo mo'ed b'hem shemayim v'aretz omar Moshe ani bosav adam l'moch ani meis imro in yom yisrael lo kibalno olena abris mi bo makhisham l'ficho chayed b'hem shemayim v'aretz edim she'hem kayomim l'olam. So he says because they exist forever. V'od, he says, she'em yizku yavohu ha'edim v'yitnu schor. And also he says, because if there'll be zocher, so these two witnesses will give their schar. Hagefen titen pirya, okay, the vine will give its fruit. Va'aretz titen yevula, and the earth will give forth its goods. V'ashamayim yitnu talon, and the heavens will give the rain and the dew. V'im yischayvu tiyeh bohem yad ha'edim tchila. And if they don't keep it, so then the Edom will be like the Edom, Yad Edom Tia Bo Bereshona. So the Allah is the Edom of the first ones to kill him. So two of here, these two Edom will act. And Va'otzer as a Shemayim v'lo yiyamotor v'adom v'lo sitein es yivula v'acharkach v'avalta meira al yedei ovdei kachavim. Okay, that's a Rashi says. So what is Rashi? What's unusual about Rashi is that Rashi ties two things together that really seem to be have nothing to do with each other. All right. Of course, the first thing is they should be Edom. And the second thing is that these Edom are going to react. Okay, react. I mean, it's nice, mushroom, but what is the tie? So basically, what Moshe Rabbeinu was telling Klal Yisrael, you say, what Moshe Rabbeinu was telling Klal Yisrael, what was he telling Klal Yisrael? Azino Hashemayim v'adaber v'sishmar etzemrefi. What he meant is that they are Edom. What does it mean that they are Edom? It's a mashal, of course. It's a mashal. But what does it mean that they are Edom? What he meant to say was that just like, so to speak, I mean, if you would say, if the Shemayim and the Oretz were able to speak about their existence, they would attest to the existence of the Mamzi Kol Nimtza, that basically they're a result of a metaphysical phenomena which starts with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore the Torah itself, which a person has a tendency to look at as something artificial, a person's a Yetzer Hara, tells a person, these are artificial rules, this, whatever, you see. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, no. Hazino Hashemayim v'adabera v'sishmar asem refi. That this Torah is just as real as Shemayim v'oretz, and Shemayim v'oretz could attest, if they were able to speak, they'd be able to attest to the fact that their whole existence, and that's something which everybody considers real, because only certain really crazy philosophies, I mean, deny reality. But Yahadis doesn't deny reality, and the universe is the reality that's undeniable. And what Moshe Rabbeinu was saying, that just like this reality, which you accept as being absolutely real, is true, this reality, the Shemayim Va'oretz, are really witnesses, because they are a result of the ultimate reality, which is God, which is the same source of the Torah. So don't delude yourself into thinking that the Schar V'Onesh and the whole system of Yahadus is any less real than Shemayim V'Aretz. That's basically what Moshe Rabbeinu was saying. And that's why he says that if you don't live according to the way of the Torah, so the Shemayim V'Aretz are going to act against you. What does that mean? That means to say that the ultimate reality is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore the whole physical world is completely subordinated to the system of Yahadus, which is more real than that which you consider reality. As a matter of fact, if you live according to the Torah, so then these physical existences will be subordinated to you. So the heavens and the earth are actually less real than the Torah, which a person by nature seems to think of as being less real than the physical, than the cosmos. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu was telling Klal Yisrael. Okay, so there, of course, that removes the question that we raised. The question was, what if Moshe Rabbeinu used Shemayim Va'aretz? He should have used the Borei Olam. The answer is because what Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to do, what Moshe Rabbeinu was doing was he was showing the people, it was a different concept. He was showing the people that the reality of this Torah is greater than what you consider reality, because that reality that you consider reality stems from a metaphysical source, and the metaphysical source has already told you that if you live according to this Torah, that these things will be subordinated to you. So of course, they had to use Shemayim V'Aretz, because that's the idea. You understand? There's nothing wrong. This is a different concept altogether. The Bor and the Chulda was a different idea, because in the Bor and the Chulda, you're talking about two individuals that are trying to express the concept that truth has an absolute value. So there, they made use of the Bor and the Chulda. If they were on a higher level, they wouldn't need to use the Bor and the Chulda. They would make use of the idea that it would be constantly in front of them. We wouldn't even need the whole story, because Since the Borei Olam always knows what's happening, and he's the metaphysical source of all reality, so you don't need a Barna Cholda. The fact that they needed the Barna Cholda was a weakness. It was a great thing. I mean, it wasn't a small thing. People are not on the level of those individuals who made the commitment of Barna Cholda, you see. But a higher person wouldn't need the Barna Cholda. That's what Chazal is saying. But what Moshe Rabbeinu was doing was something completely different. Different message. Different idea. What? Higher level. That's right. That is the highest level. That's what the Gemara says. So it's two different concepts. The story and the Bor and the Chulda are two individuals that are trying to recognize absolute reality, and the vehicle they used was a good vehicle, but it shows they weren't on the level of the. They wouldn't have needed this whole thing if they were on the level of having before their mind's eye the mamzik alimsa. You see, but Moshe Rabbeinu was saying something totally different. He was telling Klal Yisrael, he was giving them Musar, and he was telling them the idea he wanted to implant in them, the concept that what we think is reality and consider real is actually less real than Kala Terakola. Okay? So that's why there's no question. But all right, let's get back to the story of the bar and the Hold. There's another part to that story. That's basically what Chazal is saying. That's what they wanted to bring out. But Agav Orcha is another aspect of the story. The other aspect of the story is what happened to them. Okay, the interesting part. The part that everybody's attracted. Okay. The interesting part. The interesting part is this story that the first child was bitten by a cholda and died, and the second child fell into the bar. Okay. Yeah, what do Chazal mean by that? I mean, you have to understand. I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult to say. You know, a lot of times Chazal say things happen. Doesn't necessarily mean it happened. Like, for instance, where it says that they created a calf and they ate it every Erev Shabbos. So the Balei Kabbalah say it's not pshita. It's not pshita. Balei Kabbalah. All right. So therefore, you have to understand, when you approach a Chazal, doesn't necessarily mean, I'm not concerned about whether the story happened or didn't happen. Could be it's Derech Moshel, it could be it happened. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is the idea that you derive from the Maamar Chazal. That's really the purpose of the Maamar Chazal. So what is the idea over here? What is the concept that they're saying? What is the concept teaching? Of course, obviously, that doesn't mean that every time a person does that, this is going to happen. Okay, even if you say that the story did happen this way, it's certainly possible that it happened this way. We don't deny that. But the Chazal are not saying that every time people do this that you're going to have these supernatural occurrences. So what are Chazal teaching you with this story? Yes. But I mean, let's say it did happen. Okay? The question is not whether... It's hard to know. I mean, you have to be a tremendous chacham to be able to know in the Maamari HaGadol when Chazal are speaking Derech Moshel or not. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to know. But that's not the important thing. I mean, that's for Rishonim to decipher. Like I say, I mean, there are many, many stories in Chazal that sound very wild, and then when you see them afarshim, they explain them Derech Moshel. Like I told you, the case with the famous case where they actually made a... one time I went through Chazal, where they created a kef every Arab Shabbos. Okay, so the Balei Kabbalah said that it's Derech Moshel. But so that's something it's hard to know in Chazal. But you shouldn't. I'm just teaching you a methodology. Don't get overcome with whether it happened or not. The main thing is to understand the idea. Could be it.
But is it important that it happened?
Well, let's take the minimal that we can be sure about in this Chazal. Yeah. Yes. So what Chazal are teaching a person over here is, that everybody in life has events that take place that are untoward. I mean, untoward events. Okay? And Chazal are telling you that is really the way that the Ashgacha is melameid b'nei Adam. that the Hashgacha teaches a person. That a person, when something happens that is that they consider bad to them, this is simply the way life is made. It's set up. And many times, it is the method of the Hashgacha to teach a person, to be malamed a person, to cause him to think into his life, and to realize that what he thought was success, where he failed in being successful in attaining his goal, that is the greatest opportunity for a person to reflect and to abandon the goal, and on the contrary, to embrace something greater, which is emes. That's the story. Because he married this other woman, obviously he fell in love with somebody else, and he had two children, and he wanted to have a family with this woman, he wanted to be together with her for the rest of his life, and he's so happy when he had the children. But then something unfortunate happened, and the children died. Okay, one died through a holder, one died through a bar. But what happened was, when the wife asked him, he remembered. The incident caused him to remember the story that happened, where he made a commitment, and not just a commitment, but he took this person, and he said to them that this that we're saying is not just practical talk, it's not just a romantic conversation, okay? This is a reality. And he made that commitment, and he was on that level, and what happened was he became reduced from that level, and he abandoned the truth, and he abandoned the metaphysical reality of truth, and went after his taivas, went after he did something wrong. He didn't do a horrible thing, I mean, but he broke the commitment, and he did something wrong, and this thing that happened to him caused him to remember the incident. Okay? So what Chazal is saying is that's why Chazal prays him, because he lived the proper way. That's what Chazal says, Yefashresh Masa. It means like this. It means that we don't know what the Hashgacha is. We don't know. We don't say. We say that, let us say the incident happened Pshuto Kamashmo. Okay? We do not say, no one can say that's why the holder bit the child. I mean, that's superstitious. That's magic. We don't believe in these kind of things. Okay? But we do say that a person has to realize it could be the Hashgacha. It could be the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving this person Yisurim in order that they should come to realize something greater than what they thought was what they were looking for as success in a romantic way in a marriage. There's something greater than that. And that is the commitment to the Emes. And that's why he acted properly. But you understand what I'm saying? Everybody always wants to know, is this an act of God or not? We don't have any answer for that. Yadis doesn't have any answer. We don't know. Nobody knows. A Novi can tell you. If the Novi's not here, you don't know. But that has nothing to do with the way a person should live his life. The way a person should live his life is that every incident that occurs, if it brings to mind something which shows him the truth, so then he must embrace the truth. And he's chayav in shevach vadar. He's chayav in shevach vadar because either it's hashgacha pratius, in which case he's certainly chayav in shevach vadar, or else hashgacha kwalis. Hashgacha kwalis, he's also chayav in shevach vadar. Not just hashgacha, but hashgacha. People only want hashgacha pratius because they're egocentric. But hashgacha kwalis, you're also chayav in shevach vadar. It's because God set up the system, and this is the way the system works, and incidents happen like this, and they serve to remind you of your chatoyim, of your failures and your mistakes and your weaknesses and your shortcomings, and therefore when you analyze them and you abandon the course of the instincts and you follow the MS, the truth, you're chayv and shevach vador. Chayv and shevach vador. That's what I often give a mashal. If a person would create a beautiful park, a beautiful garden, and on the outside it's anyone that wants can walk in here and enjoy it. So an individual walks in and enjoys the park. Is he chayev and shevach vador to the person that did it? Of course, he's asking makatov. Yes, he's makatov. He's mechuyev. He didn't know you. He didn't know you personally, but he did a chesed. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu's chesed is not just in terms of Hashgacha Pratius. It's in terms of Hashgacha Klolius as well, because he set up a system where when a person in life makes maneuvers and moves and something goes wrong, so that something goes wrong can remind him of a failure within himself. And therefore, he foregoes something which he considered to be success. He lets that go, and instead he embraces the emes, the truth. This is Godless Adam, and this is Chesed HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's basically what the story is telling you. Okay, that's the second part of the story. Okay, so now we only have one question. William James. Well, I see what happened. What happens is that once you see the amitis of Torah, you can tolerate the kasha. But I'd like to give an answer to the kasha. All right? No, I think James has simply made a simple mistake. Okay, I mean, just to answer the kasha. Well, James made a mistake between two. See, the mind has many parts to it, many components, and he simply got confused between two different phenomena of the mind. Okay, you see, when a person said, and I'll show you why he made the mistake. He made a mistake because it's close, but he wasn't really sharp enough to distinguish categorically. The thing is like this. He considered when the person leaps, he has to think he's going to make it. Okay, it's very, he put it in vague terms. That thing's going to make it. And it sounds right. That thing's going to make it. So James thought that what the person is doing is making a judgment that he's going to make it. That's not true. If you think into it, it's not true. When a person leaps and thinks he's going to make it, that's not the same thing as making a judgment that he's going to make it. Okay? What James made it say like this. You see, when a person makes a judgment and he has two possibilities in front of him, so he outrules one possibility and he endorses another possibility. That's how you make a judgment. You say, A is true, B is false. Could be either A or B, so I outrule B, and A is right. That's a method of making a judgment. Okay? Now, James thought that with the person, in order to jump from the cliff to the rock, had to do the same thing. It's close to it in the fact that the person on the cliff has two possibilities and he outrules one possibility. Okay? But he's not outruling one possibility because he's interested in making a judgment. At this time, he's not interested in making judgments. His mind has before it two possibilities. He must outrule one possibility in order to make the leap. And that is true. But just because it's the same mechanism of outruling possibilities does not mean it's the same phenomena as sitting in judgment. It means in order for him to make the leap, he must remove one possibility from his mind. That does not mean that he's making a judgment. All it means is that he can't think of that possibility at this moment. His mind must have before its eyes only one possibility. Because if the other possibility is there, then you're not going to be able to do it. But that is not the same thing as sitting back and making a judgment. Is it true that I am going to make this leap, or I'm going to be successful, or not? If you'd stop the person at any point and ask him whether he really thinks 100% he's going to make it, of course he'd tell you he doesn't know. You see? It's not a process of judgment. You see? It's a different kind of phenomenon of the mind. It means that at a certain time, a person has to, in order to function, a person has to remove a certain possibility. Because as long as that possibility, as a matter of fact, at that moment, he cannot be in a state of judgment. That's basically that's the real truth of the phenomenon. At a certain moment, the person can always be judging. He can't be, if he decides to judge, then he's not going to be able to make the leap. If he leaps, he has to remove the concept of being a judge. What does he have to do, though? He has to outrule a certain possibility and only concentrate in his mind. He should only see one possibility. Okay? That is simply a method of dealing with the situation and use of the imaginative faculty of the mind. In other words, he must bring before his mind only one picture. Okay? James made a mistake in thinking that it's a judgment, because it has a very similar process. When you're making a judgment, so you have two possibilities, so you outrule one, and you say the other one is true. Now, over here, it's similar in that sense that you have two possibilities and you're outruling one. But the mistake he made was the category is not judgment. The category is simply what is present in the mind at a certain time. And in order to make the leap, only one idea must be present in his mind. But it's not a process of judgment. That's where he made a mistake. As a matter of fact, if the man's involved in judgment, he's definitely going to fail. It's a time when the person can't be involved in judgment. But that doesn't mean that and since he's not involved in judgment, it's not a non-truth. Okay? You understand what I'm saying? There's a difference between using your imagination to place a certain possibility in front of it and that idea only. That's a certain mechanism of using the mind. And there's a difference between sitting in judgment over two possibilities. James made a mistake because they have something similar in the sense that you must outrule one. But one is an outruling because of judgment, and the other is an outruling simply practically. You can't possibly function unless you outrule one possibility. That's not a process of judgment. So therefore, the person that makes the leap is not in denial of the truth. He can accept metaphysical reality. Okay, so the last point we mentioned was that there's a difference between a judgment where a person is evaluating a situation and where a person is what they call today psyching oneself out, which means that you're concentrating on one possibility. Okay, and that was the mistake that we pointed out that James made. He confused those two and considered them one when they're really two different phenomena. Okay. I'm not going to explain any further. I think you have to think into it yourself. Okay. There's another aspect of this chazal, which I think is important. I think it's a fundamental principle, and a very important principle in Yahadis. And I think that chazal are bringing it out with this story. And the story, we question whether the story was pshuto kamashmo or not. I mean, that's always a question. But I think that in this case we really can say that it is pshuto kamashmo. It is pshuto kamashmo. Okay, and I think that in the pshuto kamashmo over here, there really is an interesting principle, an important principle, very important principle, and that principle is how we relate to the Ashgacha. How a human being is supposed to relate to the Ashgacha. Okay. Because, as you know, there are various theories, as the Rambam sets forth in the Mor Nevuchim, various theories of the way God relates to man. Okay, and the Rambam presents all the theories in the third book, in his third book on divine providence. Okay, I'm not going to go through now all the various theories. I mean, the Rambam dealt with those theories because, of course, I mean, there were possibilities and there were philosophies that existed at the time. I mean, the two reasons why a philosopher takes up theories. One reason is because it's a logical possibility. Another reason is because they are prevalent and they have to be dealt with. But I'm not going to go into the Rambam's other theories. I would like to go into the Rambam's own theory, Alashgacha. And I think there's something that's missing here that I think is an important yesod. And I think that this story over here with the Chul and the Bor really, really brings it out. Okay. And that's why I say that the story can be taken pshuto kamashmo. There's reason to believe that it's that the story is pshuto kamashmo, and there's no problem with the pshuto kamashmo if you understand the idea behind it. Okay. All right. As you know, the story was that there was a romantic affair between these two people, and they made a commitment, and they used the chul and the bor to be witnesses, And what happened was that the man went away and he forgot about his commitment to marry this young girl. And what happened was he married somebody else. And then one child died by a chulda, another child died by falling into a bar. And then he what happened was that she questioned. He didn't question. That's important. She questioned, and she said, "What is this strange thing that happened that's so unusual?" So he remembered his commitment, his shvua, his swear that he made to this young girl, and he told her the story, and then she said, "Divorce me and go back and marry her." That was the story. That's the way Taish says. The Orach has, I'm glad somebody showed me the Orach, because there's something I wanted to say that really fits in very well with the additional information that the Orach gives about this story. All right. So, of course, I mean, as you know, the Rambam Shita is that we don't say that everything that happens in this world is a result of divine providence, Hashgacha Pratius. Like the Rambam is against the position that not a leaf will fall from the tree unless it's God's will. That means that every single event is directly under divine providence. The Rambam is against that. Because the Rambam maintains that there is a general Hashgacha, which means general Hashgacha means that it's God's will that there should be certain laws in nature. And those laws in nature have to do with the inanimate and with the animate life and with the species, the various species on this planet. And the Rambam maintains that those are all subject to chance, although there is a general direction. Pretty much like Tilim Kuf Dalid, Barchi Nafshi reads. Okay? Marab Masechet Hashem, Kulam Mechach Masisa, and it's God's wisdom that these laws of nature should exist, and things that happen are not a result, in that world, things that happen are not a result of divine providence, of Hashgacha Pratius. And the Rambam in the Mora presents this in his, what he calls the fifth theory, okay? And the question is, in the fifth theory, he says this is the theory of Chazal, and then he also says, and now I will explain my opinion on it. And he maintains that his opinion is based on his own study of the Nevi'im, the Torah and the Nevi'im, and of Chazal. And of course the question is, the Rambam is always very cryptic, it's hard to understand, what's the difference between the theory of Chazal and his theory? Is it different? Is it not different? Okay? And much has been written on that, because the Rambam is very vague about that. But in my opinion, I don't think that when the Rambam differentiates between his opinion and the opinion of Chazal, I think what he's saying is not that he differs from Chazal. I mean, I'm talking about it, I mean, b'tchilas ayyun, okay, because I really haven't spent a lot of time on it, but it would seem to me that what the Rambam is saying, when the Rambam talks about the theory of Chazal, he's talking about the framework that Chazal received from Sinai. Okay, but he does not find in Chazal a clear explanation of how it works and why it works. In other words, it's like anything else. It's like studying a sugya. I mean, the Mishnah is really Tarsha Baal Peh that we receive from Sinai. And of course, then the Gemara analyzes it and gives the theories. In my opinion, what the Rambam is saying is not something necessarily that he deviates from what Chazal is saying. He does criticize one theory of Chazal, which is that a person can get an onesh, can get a punishment, even though there's no chait, in order to improve him. But that's a side point. But what the Rambam is concentrating on, in my opinion, is that he is simply stating the general theory of the Mesorah from Sinai on the basic points, and then he gives his own theory and understanding of how it works. And of course, when he gives his theory and his own understanding, there are certain details that stand out. Okay, which, if you just kept to the basics, which Chazal are quoting, would not necessarily emerge. That's why he calls it his own theory. Okay, essentially, what his theory is that even in man, Okay, because he shows from the Nevi'im that the species are not really under the direct influence of divine providence. But what the Rambam isolates is, what the Rambam shows is, that the concept of Hashgacha is not that God simply decided to give Hashgacha to man, which of course is the Yesod and Kol HaTorah Kula, but that it works in a very specific manner. And because it works in that manner, what emerges is that there are different levels of divine providence, of Hashgacha Pratius. And the Rambam's concept is, the Rambam's idea is, that Hashgacha is not, again, not simply that God decided to relate to man, like it's a decision simply out of his will or his wisdom, and you can't go beyond that. But the Rambam holds that it works with a certain way that we can understand, that makes sense, of course, up to a point. I mean, you know, the Rambam's method of understanding philosophy, metaphysics, is very much tied. I mean, very much tied to an understanding and an evaluation of the limits of our own intellect. That's where I think the Rambam is unique, because the Rambam shows in the Mora that many of the questions that are raised about God, this is an unbelievable, if you go through the Mora, you'll see this Yisod stands out. And the Rambam shows that many of the philosophical problems that some of the greatest philosophers have raised about God and God's knowledge and God's omniscience is based on one flaw, and that is an attempt to equate God's intellect with man's. And that is the source of most of the problems. The Rambam shows that once a person recognizes that our intellect is completely different, then the problems simply vanish. And he shows that the problems are engendered by a false assumption, namely an attempt to project onto God human-like intellectual qualities. Of course, the Avodah Zarah, the concept of Avodah Zarah is to project onto God human qualities. That's outright Avodah Zarah. But the Rambam shows that the philosophers made a mistake in that while they didn't do that, they recognized that's Avodah Zarah, but they made a mistake in the fact when it came to the world of the intellect, there they were careless. And a lot of their questions are based on a false assumption, namely that the questions that are raised are based on the human intellect. And therefore, a lot of the questions, like how could God's knowledge change? If you say that God knows particulars, so at one time his knowledge is going to be this way, and then when the particulars change, his knowledge is going to change. So therefore, it will come out that there's a change in God, which is inadmissible. So the Rambam shows that that question, a question like that, and many others, is simply based on the fact that in our intellect, that's the way it is, because we're perceivers from the outside, so to speak. And therefore, when things change, our intellect changes. But God's intellect is not that kind. Incorrect to ascribe to God the characteristics of our own intellect, and then, of course, raise these questions. That's really an essential point in the moral. That man doesn't usually like to recognize his own inadequacies and his own limits, especially when it comes to the intellect. And philosophers, while they may recognize the defects that we have because of our biological makeup, but when it comes to the intellect, there was a certain false arrogance and an assumption that our intellect is supreme, and therefore, once you make that judgment, then of course you're going to say, well, God's intellect, how come you're going to equate the two, and you're going to raise a lot of questions which are completely unjustified, because you have no right to extrapolate from our intellect to God's, which is a completely different phenomenon that's beyond our ability to understand. And that's one of the great things of the moment. When you look at it, you see that it was that tendency that caused many philosophical questions to be raised, and that's why the Rambam dismisses them. But what the Rambam says over here is very interesting. The Rambam says that you can understand something about divine providence, namely that divine providence, we do have an intellect, And our intellect is in some manner related to God's, in the sense that we have some kind of an ability to tune in to God's chachma on a certain level. Okay? And what the Rambam says is that is the link between man and God, the Tzelem Elokim. The Rambam says, and that's why the Rambam says, the reason why the other species are not under divine providence is not because God decided that they shouldn't be, they're not worthy, but man is worthy, but there's a more intrinsic reason, namely that man is endowed with an intellect, and the intellect is the connection. The intellect is the link. That's the connection. That's where divine providence really, that's where the concept of divine providence really rests, really exists. Okay, so therefore the Rambam says basically that since that is the case, so what will happen is that an individual, insofar as he is perfected in terms of his intellect, will have a greater degree of divine providence, will be subject to divine providence to a greater degree, because it is through the intellect that man relates to God, and it's that relationship between man and God which takes him out of the sphere of the realm of the normal, of the natural law, because he is relating to God in a direct manner which places him above the causal effects of nature, and therefore his existence is totally different. Is different. He's removed from the he's removed from the realm of natural law. You see, now that's why the Rambam says that the righteous have divine protection. Okay, the righteous have divine protection. Okay, the Rambam says those who approach him. He says.
In the third book?
In the third book, yeah. Chapter 17, chapter 18. Okay? That's what Rambam says, for instance, in the end of chapter 17. Those creatures, therefore, which receive part of that intellectual influence will become subject to the action of providence in the same proportion as they are acted upon by the intellect. That's what Rambam says. Okay? This theory is in accordance with reason and with the teaching of Scripture, whilst the other theories previously mentioned either exaggerate divine providence or detract from it. In the former case, they lead to confusion and entire nonsense and cause us to deny reason and contradict that which is perceived with the senses. The latter case, where they detract from divine providence, the theory that divine providence does not extend to man and that there is no difference between man and other animals implies very bad notions about God. It disturbs all social order, removes and destroys all the moral and intellectual virtues of man. Because what it means is that all the intellectual and moral virtues of man have no real existence. The moment you say that the divine, that God is not involved with man in any way, that means that man's perfection and his virtues are not real. Because insofar as something is real, it has to relate to God. So that when you remove it from God, it means it's less real. Okay? So the existence of the species is less real than the existence of man. Because the existence of man is related to God in a greater way. And since God is the ultimate reality, as one approaches God, one is in a more real state of existence, exists more truly. So therefore the Rambam says that to deny divine providence is really to undermine the virtues of man, because you're saying that these virtues are not in direct relationship with God, which gives them less real existence. Okay, then of course you can get thrown into a pragmatic world, like we mentioned last week. You see, but that's what the Rambam is very much against, either detracting or else exaggerating divine providence, because when you exaggerate divine providence, then you have nonsensical results. Okay, you say that everything's under divine providence, and the Rambam says, and therefore you'll come out with absurdities, that certain things that happen to people, which are obviously absurd, you're going to have to explain in crazy ways, or the Rambam says, for instance, the idea that animals are under divine providence, and therefore when a particular animal is torn apart by a lion, so this animal is going to get a reward in the world to come, which is these kind of absurdities, which the Rambam mentions before. And so the Rambam says that to detract or to add is really to destroy the true idea of divine providence. But the true idea of divine providence is in line with reason, makes perfect sense, and when one understands it, he says one sees actually not again. I mean, you can't understand, no one can understand how God works, but one can see rationally what the concept of divine providence is. And it makes perfect sense. Okay. Now, the Rambam says, the Rambam speaks about the divine protection, and he says like this. Again, he says, for it is the intensity of the divine intellectual influence that has inspired the prophets, guided the good in their actions, and perfected the wisdom of the pious. Okay. I think that is one of the most important statements here. What I want to do is come around and explain that one sentence. I mean, that sentence really sums up in a very important way that I think is very often overlooked what exactly the Rambam's shita was on divine providence. Because I think most people walk away with an idea that from the Rambam that somehow or other, I mean, that we can't relate to God in any way, because we never know whether we're under divine providence or not. So then it becomes like the person I would say. See, Aristotle's concept was that there is no divine providence. Everything is simply natural law, even with regard to man. Okay, the Rambam rejects that. That's against Kolotarikah law. Okay, but the thing is that what I would say is that many people who read the Rambam, they're satisfied with the Rambam intellectually, but in their practical life, I mean, a person can simply wind up existing like an Aristotelian. Okay? It's out there. There is divine providence. But on a practical level, it has no meaning. Because you never know what is divine providence. You don't know what isn't divine providence. You don't know if what happened, since the Rambam states that according to his theory of divine providence, which is the true theory of the Torah, he says, according to that theory, it depends on the individual. So he says the avos were on extremely high level. So everything was under divine providence. The Rambam says, even their passions. He says, consider how the action of divine providence is described in reference to every incident in the lives of the patriarchs, to their occupations, and even to their passions, and how God promised to direct his attention to them. Thus God said to Abraham, I am thy shield. And the Rambam goes on. And then he says, when we see that some men escape plagues and mishaps, while others perish by them, we must not attribute this to a difference in the properties of their bodies or their physical constitution, for by strength shall no man prevail. Okay? But it must be attributed to their different degrees of perfection, some approaching God, whilst others moving away from them. Those who approach him are best protected, and he will keep the feet of his saints. Ragla Chesed of Yishma. But those who keep far away from him are left exposed to what may befall them. There is nothing that could protect them from what might happen. They are like those who walk in darkness and are certain to stumble. The protection of the pious by providence is also expressed in the following passages. He keepeth all his bones. The eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous. He shall call upon me and I shall answer him. There are in Scripture many more passages expressing the principle that men enjoy divine protection in proportion to their perfection and piety. Okay. And he says, even Plato says, those who possess the faculty of raising their souls from virtue to virtue obtain, according to Plato, divine protection to a higher degree. So he says that our theory is in line with Plato's theory. Okay. Now, So on the one hand, the Rambam is saying that if you see somebody escapes a tragedy, you must ascribe it to divine providence. On the other hand, he says, it seems to be like somewhat of a contradiction when you go through his ideas on this topic. Because on the one hand, he says, when you see something happen, so you can't ascribe it to the laws of nature. On the other hand, he says that each person is different. So a person that's on a lower level, basically, he can ascribe it to chance. He says it depends on the person. And that's why I mentioned before, he says that according to his theory, he says in the same proportion as ignorant and disobedient persons are deficient in that divine influence, their condition is inferior, and their rank equal to that of irrational beings. And he quotes, and they are like unto beasts. Okay? So he says that. So he says, and that's what it means. He says when we say according to in the Torah that that God provides for every individual human being in accordance with his merits is one of the fundamental principles on which the law is founded. But the Rambam explains that to me in terms of the person's chachma. Insofar as a person is tied to true chachma, that's what it means by his merits. Okay. So what I'm saying is, when one walks away from the Rambam, what happens is, most of the time, what happens is that it's very nice and the theory is beautiful and it makes sense. But the question is, like the Rav one time said, I mean, practically, what does it mean in an individual's life? So a person can walk away from the Rambam, and practically he's living like an Aristotelian, because he simply doesn't know, well, there's a chance, there's this. I mean, that's something which I think is extremely important to address, and it's extremely important, I can't think of anything almost more important, because it has to do with your personal relationship with God. I mean, the question is, do I have a... Of course, God relates to us in a certain manner, and in accordance with our level of chachma. But the question is, insofar as we are concerned, so what does this mean to us? I mean, so we just, is it a blank? You just draw a blank and that's it. You just hope for the best. You hope that you hope that you have divine protection. Nothing more than that? Or is there something, or must it affect our approach to life and how we look at life? And actually give us some meaning in our relationship to God? So I think that's the problem with the Mora, is that people walk away. The Rambam was very abstruse, as he mentions many times. Read this over several times. But the point is, most people don't have that ability to walk away with this kind of logical Aristotelian approach. But when you look at the Rambam, you see he's not really saying that, because the Rambam says himself that when you see something happen, you have to interpret it as a matter of divine providence. I mean, but how do I know? I mean, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to use as a barometer? Am I on the level? Am I not on the level? So it just remains a logical, abstract question, but has no practical value, and that can't be. Okay, that can't be. So that's the point I would like to address. I mean, to show that what the Rambam is saying is, the Rambam is not saying that. The Rambam is not saying that a person should simply sit back and be removed from the phenomena of divine providence. But actually what the Rambam maintains is that divine providence really has a very significant and essential part in the human being's life, but the way the Rambam saw it is not the way the Hamonam sees it. It's a different thing. It's a far deeper thing, but yet there is a way for an individual, for a human being to relate to God and to Ashgacha Pratis, even though he doesn't have any knowledge, can never have any knowledge as to what the ultimate Ma'aseh Hashem are, because it's beyond human ability. And I think that has to do with the story of the Chul in the Bar. Okay? Has to do with the story of the Chul in the Bar. See, what was the story of the Chul in the Bar? The story of the Chul in the Bar was that there's two aspects to it. One was the philosophical we took up last week. But then you have the individual part of the story, the specifics of the story, and that was when they saw that the Chulder killed one baby and the Bar killed another baby. Okay, that's a perfect example. So what should a person say in such a situation? Should they say, "Well, look, I'm not under Hashgacha, and who knows? It's just coincidental. A lot of coincidences happen. Correct? A lot of coincidences happen." Or should a person say, no, it's Hashgacha? I mean, it's a very difficult thing. How can we know? I mean, the Rambam himself says you can't know. A person, the human being, can't know. You can know the patriarchs. Okay, fine. Yeah. But what I think is that if you look into it more deeply, you'll see that, and that's why I say that this Chazal should be interpreted Pshuto Kamashmo. What Chazal mean is like this. And really it's an extension of what the Rambam's theory is. And that is that, you see what the Rambam says, let me repeat this one sentence. I think it's really the main sentence in the whole chapter insofar as the practical is concerned. Okay, it runs like this. Okay. he says, the relation of divine providence, it's in chapter 18, I mean, it's on page 289 in the paperback. This, he says, the relation of divine providence is therefore not the same to all men. The greater the human perfection a person has attained, the greater the benefit he derives from divine providence. This benefit is very great in the case of prophets, varies according to the degree of their prophetic faculty, as it varies in the case of pious and good men according to their piety and uprightness. Now he says, for it is the intensity of the divine intellectual influence that has inspired that has inspired the prophets, guided the good of in their actions, and perfected the wisdom of the pious. Okay, what does he mean by that? I mean, what is that? That's like the that is actually the statement that where he reaches the apex of his philosophy. Okay, because then he goes off to the ignorant and the disobedient. But this is really the whole chapter. Attains its ultimate state in that last sentence. Well, what is he saying there? See, what the Rambam is saying is the following principle. That, I mean, take for instance, you have by David HaMelech. So David HaMelech talks about how the Ashgacha worked for him. If you go through the Shira, he explains how every step was Hashgacha. So you could say, I mean, David HaMelech was a Navi, and therefore he knew it. I mean, it doesn't seem to be that way to me. But moreover, you see, David HaMelech says, Hareini Hashem Darkecho Anecheini Baruch Mishalaman Shoroi. So he's asking God, Hareini Hashem Darkecho, teach me your ways. What would he mean, he teach me your ways? Unecheini Baruch Mishalaman Shoroi. What did that mean? He expected God to simply reveal himself and give him a lesson and teach him personally. I mean, that's absurd. I mean, the Torah was given to Maamar HaSinai. There are no individual Maamar HaSinai's. I mean, of course, it does say there is what the Rambam says personal nevuah, where a person is misrache. He gains more knowledge through personal nevuah, not through nevuah of shlichus. That is true. But it doesn't seem that way from the Psukim. Hareini Hashem Darkecho Anecheini Baruch Mishor seems to be that in life itself that God is a Malamed. Hareini Hashem Darkecho means through life's experiences themselves God is the Malamed. So it means that we must have some way to unlock the secrets of life's experiences and to see how God is a direct Malamed in our personal lives. I mean, that's what he's asking for. Hareini Hashem Darkecho, Unecheini Baruch Mishor, Laman Shoroi. So what is that method? How does a person do that? How does a person see the Ashgacha? How does a person able to be a Talmud of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Malamed Tar Lama Yisrael, to be a Talmud of God in this existence? That's the question. Okay? That's the question. What do these psukim mean? And as I say, it doesn't seem from the psukim that the psukim are really saying that he knew these things through nevuah, the shira. It seems to be an assessment, a rational understanding, an assessment of what happened to him, and the ashgach. I think the answer is contained really in the second half of the story. Again, of the chul and the bor. What it means like this: here you had two people, okay, that at a certain point, okay, they had an experience together, a romantic experience, and they made a commitment. And what they stated was that this commitment is not just an emotional, temporary, political kind of a commitment. It's a genuine commitment based on reality. The reality of the boar, of the inanimate, is a witness. And the reality of the chulda, of the weasel, of the animate, those are the witnesses. Just like they are real, this commitment is real. So what it means to say is that those people, when they made such a commitment, it was a commitment which was beyond the ordinary romantic emotional. It was a commitment to get married, and the commitment was based upon reality and not based upon the temporary emotions of the moment. They went beyond the instinctual and the emotional, and they really recognized the world of ultimate reality and based their commitment on ultimate reality. So you have to, when people talk like that, it means they're different kinds, different kind of people. Most people in romantic situations don't talk that way. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not part of that framework. So they went beyond the ordinary framework. So they were on a very high level. These people were on a very high level at that moment. They were on that level. What happened was that she remained on that level, but he slept. Okay, he slept. And you see from the story, that's what the story says. He forgot about her, and then he married somebody else, and he had kids, and then when these events occurred, he didn't even faze him. Okay, she was the one that the second wife was the one that brought his attention. She said something unusual was going on here. This is not the Derech B'nei Adam. Okay, and then he came. Then he started to think back, and he remembered the story. What does that show you? It shows you that there was a certain block that he had over the whole incident. Because why? He should have certainly remembered it. Happened to him. I mean, why did he? She was a stranger. She never even knew anything. And she noticed something strange and she started to ask him. He was the one that lived through those events. He should have immediately thought of the hole in the bar. Okay? You don't need any better sign than that. But the answer is that he slipped. He slipped. He was on a high level at that moment. And at that moment, when he used the hole in the bar, he was a person that made a commitment based upon reality and based upon an expression of God's reality in the animate and the inanimate, and of course, ultimately, God. But Chazal say a higher level person would simply not have to make recourse to the Chol Nebar. But nevertheless, the fact that he did make recourse to the Chol Nebar, it was like an indirect way of working his way back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and to the ultimate source of all reality that we see. So he was on a very high level. But what happened? Something happened to him. He slipped from that madrega, he went down, and he got into the world of the emotional. You see, and he was basically, he built up a wall against that other kind of life, you see. And therefore, when the Chuldan, the Bor incident happened to him, he simply didn't even recognize it. And it was necessary for a stranger to recognize it, because the stranger didn't have any block, you see. So what a Chazal. So what happened after that? So what happened after that? Once she mentioned it to him, and he recognized what happened to him, what happened to himself, and he was a chozer b'tshuva. He was a chozer b'tshuva, and he recognized that he really was wrong in abandoning a commitment which was based on ultimate reality and just following his romantic emotions and marrying somebody else. And he was a chozer b'tshuva. He was a chozer b'tshuva. He saw that he slipped. He went down. He went down. He went down in terms of his levels. He was reduced to from a person that was in line with a certain recognition of reality to an individual just following his emotions. So when he recognized that, he was a chozer b'tshuva. He was a chozer b'tshuva, and then he went back to the original to the original girl, the original one, and he married her. And it's interesting. The Orach elaborates a little. The Orach says that what happened was he said he went back to her, and they said that she has a mum, and he said accept any mum that she has, and he that she was alone and she wouldn't marry anybody. And then it says he told her the story of the Chuldan Bor, and she said afani bevrisi amadati miyad nisyashva daiton uforu v'ravu bevonim uvenachosim. So they were successful with children and their wealth. V'aleim akosvama einai b'neamone eretz. Okay. So you see, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, "Ein I b'nei mon eretz." My eyes are on those that live in truth. So what are Chazal saying? Basically, what are Chazal saying? Chazal is saying that a person, a human being, has to seek out. You see, the principle of divine providence is not simply, it's not an abstract Aristotelian principle. See, it's a principle that involves directly our lives on a personal level. What it means is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu relates to man whenever man passes out of the world of the instinctual into the world of Chachma and into the world of reality. That's where the Borei Olam is. That's where God is. And in that sphere, God functions to relate to man, and all the sea of events that we find ourselves in, you see, we relate to God through those events, insofar as those events spark in us, you see, a recognition of emes, of truth. There a person is mechuyev to say, because that's God's plan. You see, divine providence is not simply an abstract philosophical phenomenon. It's a plan. What does it mean? By a plan, I mean it's part of God's plan in the creation. It's part of the way God relates to man. In other words, when God created man, it was with the idea that he's selam alokim. It means that he relates to him in a certain way. He teaches him. He's melamed. Hareini Hashem darkecha. So it means to say that through the sea of events, whenever you slip through and you break through the instinctual into the world of ideas and chachma and reality and truth, nemoni eretz, that's what the Gadol Chazal are talking about. Even in a romantic situation, you see, a romantic situation, but these people broke through from the romantic, they went into the real, they made access to reality. So that's where then God is a melamed. Then that is part of the plan of human existence. It's intrinsic in human existence. The Rambam is not just telling you an abstract philosophy. The philosophy of the Rambam is philosophical, true, but it's practical as well. I mean, this is the whole story of the Avos. So it means to say that a person does have a way, according to the Rambam, to relate to God and God's Hashgacha. Because since this is the very plan of human existence, whenever a person encounters that, he must say, he must recognize it. Of course, and that, of course, an individual, you see, an individual can never maintain. There are two different things here simultaneously, but they're not mutually exclusive. Namely, while an individual can never say in a given event, a person cannot say he knows that this was Hashgacha Pratis, because a person doesn't have a right to say that. But simultaneously, that does not mean that when a person sees the divine plan and recognizes the enactment of the divine, it follows the pattern of the way God relates to man, a person must live according to that reality. And he must embrace that reality and must see in it, you see, he must see in it God's plan. Do you follow what I'm saying? It sounds like a contradiction, but it's not. In other words, since a person knows that the whole concept of divine providence, that's why I say that sentence is so important, because the Rambam says that the intensity of the divine intellectual influence that has inspired the prophets guided the good of their actions and perfected the wisdom of the pious. So it means that Hashgacha Pratis is a part of, not simply to protect the person, but it's a part of perfecting the individual's righteousness and piousness. So it means to say that in that sphere, God is a malamed. So that was the story of the chulda and the bar. Why? Because why did God relate to this person, to this human being? Because he broke through the instinctual barrier and went into the world of absolute reality. He said the chulda and the bar is not just an empty romantic emotional moment, but he went beyond that, and she went beyond that, and they said that this is a commitment on a higher level based upon reality. So when a person does that, you see, the moment the person does that, then they've broken through the area of chance, which the Rambam says chance applies to the animal kingdom and to man insofar as he's an animal. But insofar as he removes himself from the animal, he's moving into the range of the divine providence. Now, once a person does move into that range, if a strange event occurs which causes him to think into his own life and see how he has deviated from the original path, if he were on a correct path, like this person was, and he sees that these incidents are saying something to him, but they're teaching him an idea to correct him and to bring him back to reality, then an individual must say that is Hashgacha, because that is the general plan of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So